welcome back to the Shades of Magic read-along. It is the final week, week 10. We will be covering the end of A Conjuring of Light, starting with part 11. Just a very quick recap of where we left off. The Lila, Kel, Alucard, Holland crew is racing back to London. In London, they have just successfully put the sleeping spell over the entire city. Tirin, the head priest, is anchoring that spell. And Lila and Kel and Holland have just begun to train using the Antari binding rings, which are going to allow them to share power, but also borrow it from each other. This is going to be important. Part 11, Death at Sea. That's an ominous title. Let's find out why. We actually start with Lennos, who is our second mate on the ship, and he is praying in his way. He is praying for balance and for guidance. And Alucard joins him, and we learn that Lennos has a gift for sensing danger. That's kind of his role with Alucard's crew. And he tells Alucard that he has a bad feeling. And Alucard says to him, a piece of magic is parading as a god, a poison fog is destroying London, and three Antari are sparring aboard our ship. I would be worried if you didn't. From there, we go to Lila, who is practicing with the rings, and it goes against everything that she has taught herself. Which is like, look out for yourself and yourself alone. Don't share, don't hand things away, don't trust in other people. But it's working. Like, they are getting stronger and they are learning how to use their magic together. They are borrowing it from each other, so when one person needs more power, they can take it from another. And they can shift their bulk of magic to whoever needs it most in that moment. We go from there to the galley where Jasta, who is the captain of this ship and also has been sending off some little red flags for us, hopefully at this point, invites Lila to a game of cards that's also a drinking game, and basically goads her into it with pride, which is one of Lila's failings. And Lila loses pretty handily and ends up extremely drunk and goes down to where Kel is staying and flirts with him and is like, hey, sexy, which is very out of character for Lila again. And then they see a ship burning in the distance. And we learned in the last section that these burned hulls of ships mark the sea serpents, which is a particular band of pirates that burns down their ship before they board another one as kind of a way of saying they're not going to need their old ship anymore because they're taking yours. We have just enough time for Lila to be like, oh my god, get Alucard, let him know. And then Lennos, who's standing on the deck, gets stabbed through the back as the sea serpents come aboard, and Lennos dies. And the fight for their ship begins. And we go to Kel, who has been training for months to be a magician in the Essintosh in the tournament, but this is his first time fighting a real battle at sea in the chaos and the melee. And he is slammed overboard, and he climbs back up, and he is nearly killed by one of the sea serpents, and Hastra saves his life. And it is Hastra's first time ever killing anybody, and so it's hard for Hastra, but he saves Kel, and that's what matters. Meanwhile, Holland, who is in the hull, stands up and feels either Kel or Lila pull away all of his magic because they are fighting up top. So he is left completely powerless for a moment as he is attacked by some of the sea serpents, and one of them says that they have been told to take his eye intact. So this was a intentional attack on the ship. This was not just some kind of opportunistic blow by the sea serpents. And then Lila's magic comes rushing in to Holland, and he is able to fight, and he basically kills them all. So we are getting the sense that our Antari magicians are now learning to kind of throw their magic to each other, though they are also taking it from each other as needed. We go to Lila, who is fighting the sea serpents, and she is so angry about what has just happened to Lennos, because Lennos is somebody she had started to bond with. Lennos is somebody who saw her and knew that she was special. Lennos is someone who believed in her and was kind to her, and she has just watched him be cut down. And so she is taking all that anger, and she is pouring it into this battle. Then she discovers Jasta, who is one of the sea serpents, who has betrayed him, who is responsible for letting them know their location, letting them onto this ship, and Jasta claims that she and Lila are the same, that they are both looking out for themselves, that at the end of the day, they are both pirates. This is everything Lila has always wanted to be, but it's now thrown back in her face at this moment, and she essentially says that she is going to kill Josta, but not until she learns everything that they are planning. We cut to the battle ending, basically. Like, the thing about this fight is that one moment it is flaring, and then the next moment it has been put down. It is over. Hastra is shaken by his first kill, but he still feels pretty proud about the fact that he was able to protect Kel. Lila drags an injured Josta onto the deck in front of everybody, and we learn that she was hired to kill Kel. That was actually the mission. And she has been hired to kill Kel and also frame the Ferrowans for it. Remember, the Ferrow and Vesk are the other two empires. Lila immediately sees this as a frame job, but we're going to come back to that in a second. She was basically like carrying tokens that would have marked this killing as a Ferrowan killing. And then she basically is like, yeah, I'm a sea serpent, and sea serpents always finish what they start. She makes a last attempt to kill Kel, and Hastra steps in the way. And it kills Hastra instead. Our sweet baby boy who just wanted to become a priest one day, who left that little plant growing in Kel's training area, who has only ever thought of himself as like he would be good as long as he did his job, which was to protect Kel. He dies protecting Kel, and Kel promptly cuts Jasta's throat in rage. Meanwhile, in Red London, Rai feels the echoes of the battle that has happened on this ship. Kel has been injured a few times in minor ways. Rai feels it. Feels the echo of his pain, and he can't rest, and so he decides to dress in his armor, which is this, of course, ostentatious gold-plated armor, and to ride out into the city. Because, again, this is something that he can do. He can be with the people of his city. And this is one of my favorite chapters. It is just one of those slightly more, like, quiet, poetic moments. I'm only going to read you the first part of it. It is Rai riding through this city where everyone is asleep. So he's riding through a city that has been cursed or enchanted or protected. It's covered in bodies. They've been like laying blankets over the bodies because everyone dropped where they were. And Rai rides through them. And it says, myths do not happen all at once. They do not spring forth whole into the world. They form slowly, rolled between the hands of time until their edges smooth, until the saying of the story gives enough weight to the words, to the memories, to keep them rolling on their own. But all stories start somewhere, and that night, as Rai Maresh walked through the streets of London, a new myth was taking shape. This was the story of a prince who watched over his city as it slept, who went on foot for fear of trampling one of the fallen, who wove his way between the bodies of his people. Some would say he moved in silence, with only the gentle clang of his golden armored steps echoing like distant bells through the silent street. Some would say he spoke, that even in the far-off darkness, the sleeping heard him whisper over and over, "You are not alone." Some would say it never happened at all. Indeed, there was no one there to see. And so it's really like Rai becoming a mythic figure in his own right. And you should know me by now that every time we have a nice quiet moment, we're about to have a really violent one right after it. And so that brings us to part 12, Betrayal. Dawn breaks over the ship, and essentially they put the bodies of the dead to the sea, and they are nearing the port of Tannic, which is where they're going to have to set out on foot to head back to London. Meanwhile, in Red London, Maxim has finished this spell that he has been working on. We don't know what it is. We just know that it is. Essentially, he is on the verge of falling apart, and this spell is now holding together. It's like holding an atomic bomb inside yourself and not letting it go off. So all he wants to do before he does whatever it is that he's going to do is have breakfast with his family one last time. He's looking for his family. He can't seem to find Rai and Amira in this moment when a guard comes and announces that the Ferrowan emissary, Solinar, that he has been caught trying to send a message out of the kingdom for help, for reinforcements. And obviously they need reinforcements. It's not a bad thing in and of itself, but in this moment where everyone is kind of eyeing everyone with suspicion, he is worried that this is an attack, this is an assault on the city, and he orders the Pharaoh and emissary to be locked up. And then he this spell that is growing inside him, this thing that he's holding inside him, is demanding to be used, is pushing him to be used. He realizes he doesn't have time to see his family. He's going to go back to his rooms. He's going to write them a letter. He gets to his rooms, and Cora is there. And remember, Cora is the Vesken princess who tried to flirt with Rye and then tried to flirt with Kel. And now she is in the king's rooms, and we should be, like, red flagging all over the place. And in fact, Cora tries to kill the king. She sees this as, like, an opportunity for assassination. The assassination attempt fails. The guards catch her in the act of trying to kill Maxim. And he's basically like, this will cost you dearly. And she says, it won't cost me as much as it costs you. And then he says, where is the queen? He realizes that nobody has been able to find the queen. Meanwhile, Rye finds the queen. Kind of by accident, Rye is walking the palace and he finds the queen in this glass ballroom, one of the five ballrooms of the city. And they're having a really important conversation about love and about family and about responsibility when they're interrupted by Cole, Cora's brother. This is the Vesken prince. And Cole draws a sword and takes his opportunity to try and kill the queen. Rye steps in the way and the sword goes through him. And Cole is like, what the fuck? Because Rye then pulls the sword out and drives it through Cole and is like, yeah, I am, it's going to take more than that. Like, Rye is embracing his mythical status. What he did not realize is that when he stepped in front of his mother and the sword went through him, the sword hit her. And the queen collapses and can't be saved and dies. We go from there to Alucard at the front of the ship, guiding the ship home, and Kel collapses because he's just been stabbed through the chest, or so it feels, because Rye has been stabbed through the chest, and he's like, oh my god, Rye needs help. We got to get back to London right now. And he's like, Alucard, you stay with the ship. And Alucard's like, I'm not going to just stay with the ship while you guys go. Meanwhile, Kel is like drawing a door spell so that he can transport them back to London. And Holland is like, don't do that. But Kel is too caught up in the moment to listen. He tries to trigger a door spell, and essentially it like repercusses. It slams him back against the deck. And what we learn, what Holland tells him, is like, you cannot make a transportation spell on a moving vessel. It doesn't work. It defies the laws of this kind of magic. And so they will not be able to get to London until they can reach land. They're going to have to get to land before they can make a transfer spell to go to London. And so basically everyone on that ship is just hoping that whatever is happening in London, that everyone's okay until they get there. Everyone is not okay. Rye goes down into the prisons and confronts Cora, the princess who was caught in the act of trying to murder the king. And he basically is like, why would you do this? And she's like, politics. And he's like, if you wanted to get ahead, you could have killed your family instead of mine. And she's like, I thought about it. And really, the whole message of this scene is like, fucking politics. Like, war games. We have been warned through the entire element games in the tournament in book two that, like, these three empires are always looking for a weakness in the other. And we also know that Cora and Cole, these two royal heirs, were two of seven. They were obviously looking for a way to, like, get an advantage in their own kingdom, and Rye's family is collateral damage to it. Meanwhile, Oseron is sitting in his shadow-made palace, and he is waiting for servants to come to him. He is waiting for his puppets, his possessed, and nobody is coming because of this goddamn sleeping spell that has been cast over the city. No one is answering him, and he gets really mad, and he decides that he's going to tear down the royal palace himself. So he gets up. Meanwhile, Maxim is grieving for his wife, for the queen, and a Ferowin ambassador, the one that he basically confined because he thought that Ferowin was sending away for an attack. Obviously, the Ferowins weren't the ones planning the attack. The Vesken's were. The Ferowin offers his condolences, and he makes reference to knowing the myths of Maxim, of this king, before he was the king, when he was the Steel Prince. And remember, I told you, I wrote this comic book series, but I did not write it or plan it before I wrote this book. So I reference all of these random-ass things that then when I built the Steel Prince comics, I had to, like, figure out the stories behind. So he's like, oh, yes, like, the Steel Prince. He says, the Steel Prince who tore the heart from the rebel army, the Steel Prince who survived the Knight of Knives, the Steel Prince who slayed the Pirate Queen. Those are the three comics. It goes Pirate Queen, Knight of Knives, and Rebel Army. And I did not know what those were. I just made them up here, and then I had to create them from scratch for the comics. Anyway, so the king and the Faerun emissary are talking when the walls of the palace begin to shake.
And this is Oceron at the doors. And Maxim is like, it's time. This spell has been growing inside me. I'm ready to face Oceron. And Rye is like, no, I have just lost my mother. I won't lose my father. The king is like, this is a king's duty. And basically Rye is restrained as Maxim leaves the palace to go face Oceron and certain death. Rye is, has a flashback of his father in the map room when he's young, telling him that a king always stands with his people. And we come back to Rye desperately trying to get to his father as he leaves the palace and Rye is left behind. And that brings us to part 13, A King's Place. Maxim Maresh, the king, he goes and he faces Oceron, and he has brought 12 members of his royal guard, and each of these 12 are spelled against possession, so Oceron cannot possess them. And Oceron tries to make puppets of them, discovers he can't, and they all have swords that are designed to sever magic at a touch. And this is very important because Oceron is going to fight Maxim. Oceron is so much stronger than Maxim, even though Maxim is an incredible fighter, and he starts to force his magic into Maxim to be like, let's see how long you last as a vessel. And he's breaking down Maxim. This is very clearly something that Maxim is not going to survive. And finally, at the very last moment, Maxim lets Oceron into his body. And then he calls all of those swords home from the other soldiers into himself. And the idea being like he has now trapped Oceron inside himself. He has drawn 12 blades that each are designed to sever magic into his own body, killing himself, but hopefully killing Oceron too. And for a moment, it seems to work. Oceron is violently wounded by this experience. He comes spilling out of Maxim. He can't get a form. He keeps like coming together and collapsing again. He is wounded, but he is not dead. Maxim is dead. Maxim does not survive this, but Oceron needs a vessel. Oceron can no longer survive in just his little shadow incarnation form. He has been weakened by this experience and he needs a body. And so what does he do? He calls to Oshka. And Oshka was Holland / Oceron's lead servant, a maid Antari, over in White London. Lila slit her throat at the beginning of this book. She was lying in residence in the palace as a corpse, and now her corpse has been called. From there, we cut to White London and Nasi, who was the child, who was like sitting with Oshka's body because she loved her so much. And so she sees Oshka's dead body sit up and stand up. And it doesn't seem like Oshka. Oshka was a dancer and a fighter, and she had this incredible grace to her. And now Oshka is a puppet. And she feels like something really bad, Nasi does, the child, feels like something really bad's going to happen. She lived through the Dane twins. She lived through Holland. And she basically covers her eyes as guards come in. She doesn't want to see what happens next. And by the time she looks again, the guards are all dead and Oshka is gone. From here, we go back to the Red London world where the ship that is carrying our Antari magicians and Alucard slams to a stop. I mean, slams to a stop as quickly as a ship can. Let's just picture the ship hitting the brakes. It comes to a stop. Lila asks why the hell they have stopped because they are nowhere near land. Alucard points to the distance where a Vescan fleet has taken up their positions. Just 100 ships. Because remember, the Vescans were planning an overthrow. That's why Cole and Cora did what they did. And Alucard essentially tells the Antari, you're going to row for shore. We're close enough to the shore. You're going to take this boat and you're gonna row, and you're gonna hope that you get there, and I'm gonna do everything I can to shield us in mist, to protect you, and if the Vescans attack, I will slow them down. But I will stay here with the ship, and you have to go. And so, with that, and Lila thinks he's joking, and he's not. So meanwhile, we have Rye, who has just lost his mother and his father, Rye, who promised Kel when Kel left that he would not do anything stupid, that he would sit and wait for 4 days because that's how long it was going to take to go and come back. Rye is now sitting with Tirin, and Tirin is spelled. Tirin is the anchor holding up the entire sleeping spell of the city, so Tirin cannot hear him, Tirin cannot answer, but Rye is completely alone. Rye has just lost his family. And he's sitting with Tirin, just wishing that the Avanessa and that the head priest, hi, wishing that the head priest could be there to talk to him and to advise him. And this is when the guards come to get him, because he is the king now. Rai has just basically become king. And the guards come and tell him of the Vesken fleet and want to know what he plans to do. Rai, who feels in no way capable of being king, but who has an incredible gift for diplomacy. And so what Rai does is Rai summons the two remaining magicians from the tournament who are Vesken. So you're making this hard. You're making this hard. This is a very complicated moment. Thomas, you're getting hair. We have a flashback as Kelsen Payne to Rai right after the events of A Darker Shade of Magic, when Kel woke up one night in pain and went to find Rai in his room hurting himself. And he apologizes to Kel. He didn't realize it was going to hurt Kel too in that way. But Rai so desperately needed to understand if he was still alive, if he was real. And this is a question that has plagued Rai ever since he came back. And meanwhile, in the present, in the boat, Lila wraps her arms around a shaking Kel because he can't stop shivering. They manage to get to land and make a doorway that leads them into the palace, where Kel does not find Rai, but does find the bodies of the king and queen lying in wait. We go from there to Alucard Emery, who is alone on the ship facing down certain death as he stares at this fleet, knowing that he'll never be able to stop that fleet, only slow them down. And in this moment, Alucard is realizing that he does not want to die. He says, standing there on the prow of the ghost, he realized with startling clarity that death and glory didn't interest him nearly as much as living long enough to go home, to make sure Bard was alive, to try to find any remaining members of the Nightspire, to see Rai's amber eyes press his lips to the place where his collar curved into his throat, to kneel before his prince and offer him the only thing Alucard had ever held back, the truth. And so he's trying to make peace with this idea that he's going to die when a message, a bird, reaches the ships and they begin to turn. Obviously, Rai's threat has paid off and the ships pull back, and Alucard essentially collapses to the deck in relief. The ships begin to turn and Alucard basically collapses to the deck in relief after having to hold that strong facade. Meanwhile, Kel is staring at the bodies of the king and queen lying in state and realizing that there is no Rai here. He learns that Rai has gone to face the Shadow King alone, and he counts the days and realizes that Rai waited exactly as long as Kel made him promise to wait, and not a minute further. And now the three Antari set off to go to the Shadow Palace to face Oseron. And that brings us to part 14, Antari. Oh my god, this is the hardest part to summarize because it's just like a lot of battle, but I'm going to do my best. But you should also read it. If you're using this read-along to just like refresh your memory, that's great. I'm going to do my best, but I like worked really hard on this battle. Okay. The closer Kel gets to the Shadow Palace, the more he feels Rai's pain. They enter and they find themselves, the three Antari find themselves face-to-face with Oseron in Oshka's body. Here's why this is interesting. Kel sees Oshka and remembers following her into White London. Lila sees Oshka and remembers killing her. Holland sees Oshka and remembers making her. So all three Antari have had a very different relationship with the vessel that Oseron is currently using, and it throws them. And then essentially Oseron in Oshka gives them the opportunity to kneel, of course, to surrender themselves. And we have a very quick flashback to them on the ship with their Antari binding rings, planning exactly how they're going to beat Oseron. And understanding that they are not going to offer one of them as a vessel, as a trapping mechanism for Oseron, until he's weakened, until he's desperate. They know that they need to push him to that point, which means they're going to have to fight him first and get him there. So the three of them fight Oseron. They're using their magic in a way. They're transferring it between them. They're working as one. They have been practicing, and they're winning. It seems like they are winning. It's so exciting. We know that's not going to last. And it doesn't. Quickly, Lila is running out of knives. She tries to use blood magic on the palace, and it essentially bends away from her because this entire palace is Oseron's doing. It only answers to him. It doesn't seem to obey the laws of reality. And Lila realizes she's going to need something that she can draw on, and she looks up, and the palace has kind of a clear ceiling because, remember, it was made out of the stadiums. And she realizes she's going to pull on the river because they're a floating palace. She's going to draw on the river. Meanwhile, Holland is now fighting Oseron, wondering why Lila is staring up over there, but it's okay. He needs to focus on fighting. And Oseron plunges Holland into blindness. He essentially wraps darkness around Holland's mind. He can't see anymore. Because remember, Holland is the one who's supposed to hold Oseron. Holland has the inheritor. Holland needs to be able to see what's happening, and he has been plunged into blindness. And right before the darkness wraps around his eyes, he sees a wave cresting over the palace. The water comes slamming down. It knocks Holland and Oseron to the ground, but Oseron gets up first. He's about to stab Holland to death, and Lila gets there, and Lila saves Holland. A thing we never thought would happen, but they have to work together. Lila saves Holland, has no time to celebrate because Oseron is now going for Kel. Kel goes to Rai, of course he does. Rai, who is trapped in this icy column full of ice spikes, and he hears Oseron come up behind him, and so he turns and he faces Oseron. Oseron is starting to look pretty worse for wear now at this point because they have been cutting up Oshka's body as much as they can, and Oseron's healing it, but it's not working. And Kel says to Oseron, that body is not going to hold. And Oseron says, you're right. And right at that moment, an ice spike drives through Kel from behind and stabs him in the back. Now, Kel is pinned against this with an ice spike driving through him, and Oseron points out that this is not a mortal wound yet. He has been very careful about where he has driven this spike through Kel's body, and he warns him to let him in. He says, this is your only chance. You're going to have to let me in. And the ice begins to withdraw from Rai as if it's a gift, right? Like pain is withdrawing from the prince as Oseron says to him, just let me in to you. Just let me in. And Kel sees the inheritor lying on the ground, a blinded Holland who has been searching for it because it has fallen and he can't see anything. Kel draws the inheritor to him, intending to use it himself. And at the last moment, Lila's steals his power away. Lila takes Kel's strength so that he can't claim the inheritor for himself. Because remember, whoever uses the inheritor is going to lose everything. And so this is a question of which one of them is going to make this ultimate sacrifice. Kel has obviously decided it's going to be him. Lila sucks the power away from him. The inheritor falls back to the ground. And then she essentially is trying to make herself the bait. Lila faces Oseron and has not got the inheritor yet, but she's going to get it. Oseron attacks her and she lights his body on fire. Now Oshka dies. Oseron has no vessel. He is in the position they wanted him to be in. He is weakened. He is desperate. Lila reaches for the inheritor now. She's going to make the sacrifice herself, and her power drops away as Holland draws everyone's magic into him and picks up the inheritor and lets Oseron in. Holland has made this ultimate sacrifice. He drives the inheritor into his hand, and he activates it so that everything that's in him pours into the inheritor. At this moment, Lila shatters the ring that's on her hand so that her magic doesn't go into the inheritor. Kel tries to get the ring off his own hand and can't get it off in time, and he starts to be torn apart inside. His magic is being ripped out of him. Rai, who has been set free from his ice prison, rushes to Kel, helps him get the ring off, and Holland burns with light for a moment as this is all happening, and then all the light goes out and Holland drops to the ground. Kel regains his senses and sees the palace crumbling overhead, no longer being held up by Oseron's magic. Holland is lying unconscious. His hair has gone from black to a shock of white. His hair has gone completely white. And the device, the inheritor, is on the ground next to him, and it is glowing black. And they have succeeded. Holland has succeeded in trapping Oseron inside the inheritor. And this last little page of the section is essentially that no one is awake to see any of it. That if all of London had woken up at that moment, they would have witnessed this mythological scene, this mythic scene. They would have witnessed these three Antari, two of them alive and awake, and one being carried out by guards. They would have witnessed the prince, now king. They would have seen it all, and it would have become the stuff of legend. But no one's awake. And with that, we head to the very last part of the book, 15, Anoche. We go to Grey London at the beginning of the scene, and the King of England, George IV, who is really pissed because Kel hasn't showed up, because he's like on his own timeline and he's like, where is the messenger? He hasn't shown up. He gets really pissed and he decides he's going to go find Kel himself. And his spies have told him that Kel goes to the Stone's Throw, right? He goes to this tavern. So he goes to the tavern where Ned, by the way, is still desperately trying to hold back all of the dark magic that has been sweeping in before they like managed to trap Oseron. All those bad vibes, remember? He's like, this is just bad vibes everywhere. It has been getting worse. He can't stay warm. Like, the tavern is clearly being possessed by some very, very dark energy. And the King of England gets there and is interrogating Ned about where Kel is when he starts to feel all that bad vibes. And he's like, I don't like this. And essentially, he's a coward, and he turns tail and gets out of the tavern as quickly as possible. He's like, bad vibes across the board. Meanwhile, Rye is in Red London when he receives news from Vesk saying that they are disarming and they are disavowing what the prince and princess did. Essentially, they're like, they're dead to us. You should execute Cora, who's still alive. And we're even going to offer you our youngest, Hawk, who is like the seventh of seven, as a consolation for please don't go to war with us. Rye is so tired of death and of murder, but he knows that he has to do his kingly duty and he has to execute Cora. And he goes down to the prisons to fulfill that duty to find that Cora has executed herself. And he is honestly just relieved at that point that he does not have to do any more bloodshed in this moment. Meanwhile, Lila and Kel go to Grey London, where they find Ned, who is so relieved to see them because he's like, you have no idea what I've been going through. They assure him that it's over, but they have a very large favor to ask of Ned Tuttle. They're not going to tell him exactly what it is, but they're going to bury the inheritor with Oseron in it, in the cellar of the Stone's Throw. They feel like it's the farthest that they can get it from Black London, and it's the safest that it will be. And so they bury the inheritor and Oseron in the bowels of the Stone's Throw. Kel asks Lila if she wants to stay in Grey London for a while. This was her original city. And she says no, she just wants to go home. And the two of them return to Red London. Meanwhile, we go to Holland. Holland is dreaming. He's dreaming of being in White London, and he's dreaming of it looking healthy and alive. The sky is blue and the grass is green and everything is in full color. And he meets his brother and his lover and his best friend, all of these people that died that were important to him. And they tell him, have you heard the king is coming? The king is coming. The king is coming. And he wakes up in Red London in the palace, and he has no magic. And his eyes are both green. He has no black eye anymore. He is not an Antari anymore. And he is incredibly tired. And he asks Kel to take him back to White London, to take him to the Silverwood, which is just a grove of trees in the city that he has always liked. Some people assign a kind of mythic value to it, but honestly, he's just liked these woods, these trees. And the magic hurts Kel to do. This is what we discover, that what happened in Oseron's palace when he couldn't get the ring off in time, when the spell was being done, it has torn something inside Kel. And now magic, which has always been as easy as breathing, has just been so natural to Kel, is now agony. He's still an Antari magician in that he has access to his magic, but it's excruciating to use. But he uses it to take Holland home. And he leaves Holland there knowing that he's never going to see him again. Meanwhile, back in Red London, Alucard Emery makes the public display to Rye Maresh that he promised. He seeks an audience with the king, and he presents to Rye the mirror that he got from the floating market, the one that shows the truth, and he activates it and he lets Rai see the worst night of his life. And Alucard even says, Alucard Emery had traded 4 years of his future for the chance to relive the worst night of his past. It is the night when he leaves Rai's company and heads home, and his brother and his father are waiting for them for him, and they essentially beat him up and pile him onto a ship and send him away. And I'm not gonna, it's a pretty brutal scene, but it is the worst night of Alucard's life for a reason. And Rai watches it and he forgives Alucard for everything that's happened. He then explains to Alucard and the crowd who has gathered, no one else can see what Rai saw, only Rai could see what was in the mirror. And he says to them, and to Alucard specifically, that Kel has requested permission to travel, to go on a trip, which is something that Kel has wanted since he first got to Red London, and that he is going to require somebody at his side who can be an advisor and a protector and a guard and a companion. And he orders Alucard Emery to be his guard and gives him a way to obey the crown and serve the crown. And Alucard says yes. That night, the king comes to Alucard's rooms and they have a very sexy moment in Alucard's rooms that is about leading and following. And we repeat one of my absolute favorite lines about, so you admitted then that you are mine. And the king drags him down into bed. From there, we have a section I have to read, because I told you that the beginning, that this part was called Anosh. Anosh is a really specific word in Arnesian, and I'm going to tell you what it means because it's important. Arnesians had a dozen ways to say hello, but no word for goodbye. When it came to parting ways, they sometimes said vazir, which meant in peace, but more often they chose to say Anosh, until another day. Anosh was a word for strangers in the street and lovers between meetings, for parents and children, friends and family. It softened the blow of leaving, eased the strain of parting, a careful nod to the certainty of today and the mystery of tomorrow. When a friend left with little chance of seeing home, they said Anosh. When a loved one was dying, they said Anosh. When corpses were burned, bodies given back to the earth and souls to the stream, those left grieving said Anosh. Anosh brought solace and hope and the strength to let go. So Kel essentially goes to say Anosh to his brother. Of course, he'll be back. But that's the whole thing about that phrase, is that it doesn't tell you when. On the way to see his brother, he of course has an interaction with Alucard Emery that reminds us that these two men will never like each other. One calls one ass, the other calls one bastard, and essentially they part ways on that note. That is the closest they get to saying Anosh to each other. He goes and sees his brother, and he assures his brother that he will come back once he's seen it. And Rai says, seen what? And Kel Maresh says, everything. We cut to Lila Bard, who has now been named captain of the Night Spire, which is Alucard Emery's ship. But since Alucard is going to be staying with Rai, he doesn't need a ship anymore. He doesn't need a way to run. And Lila is enjoying being captain. From there, we go to Holland, who is alone in the Silverwood and very tired. And he thinks the king is coming. The king is coming. And he sits down against a tree and his heart winds down. And the last air leaves his lungs, and as he dies, the world around him seems to breathe in again for the first time. And we're left to wonder what that means for White London, but it seems like hope. And on the very last chapter of the book, we find Kel on Lila's ship as it is pulling out of the docks, and he has a brand new coat. It is a new side that has presented itself. It says, Kel wore a coat that billowed in the wind. It was neither royal red, nor messenger black, nor tournament silver. This coat was a simple woolen gray. He wasn't quite sure if it was new or old or something in between, only that he'd never seen it before, not until that morning when, turning his coat past black and red, he'd come across a side he didn't recognize. This new coat had a high collar and deep pockets and sturdy black buttons that ran down the front. It was a coat for storms and strong tides, and Saints knew what else he planned to find out now that he was free. So Kel is sailing away with Lila Bard, and as they pull into the river's current, he looks up at the royal palace floating over the river, and he sees Rye Maresh in the window, and Rye raises his hand, and so does Kel, and a single unspoken word passes between them, and of course it is Enosh. And that's the end. Oh my goodness, it makes me emotional to talk about. That's the end of Conjuring of Light. It's not the end of the story for anyone who survived, and even for those who didn't. And so, yeah, that brings me to the end of Conjuring of Light. I have been so honored to do this journey with you. It has really been a treat for me to revisit these books, and I cannot wait to reintroduce you to old characters and introduce you to new characters this September with The Fragile Threads of Power.